Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, it's all about film and sharing. So we'll peek into the minds of those talented artists behind the camera lens and find out what makes them tick. Artist, filmmaker Joel Tauber is on a one-man mission to shed light on the act of sharing. Why do we share? Why should we share? And why should we care? Joel's got some ideas for you to kick around, and believe you me, he's eager to share. Performance artist, photographer Diana Green is here to share the stories behind a dozen dresses, and she's got a few doozies. Filmmaker Peter Stein has made blockbuster horror film classics like Friday the 13th Part 2, but he's all about the beauty of the simple black and white image as captured by his father, renowned photographer Fred Stein. When it comes to glamour photography, they don't come more renowned than Edward Steichen, and they don't come better informed than Rinalda House curator Allison Slaby, next after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and if you're someone who appreciates great documentary filmmaking, storytelling, or the beauty of black and white photography, you're in the right place at the right time. The genius behind the late great photographers Fred Stein and Edward Steichen are coming up in the second half of the show, and we begin with two outstanding triad-based storytellers who each use photography or film in their work. Just about 15 minutes from now, Diana Green will explore the often blurry intersection of past and present in her life. The dresses she wore are helping her navigate the sometimes treacherous but always fascinating trail of personal discovery. And personal discovery forms a big part of my first guest's work as well. Joel Tauber is an assistant professor of art at Wake Forest University, where he's developing their video art program. He's an artist and filmmaker himself, whose work has been shown in solo art exhibitions at places like Suzanne Wielmetter Los Angeles Projects in L.A. and Gallery Adamski in Berlin. Joel's films have screened at festivals including the Sedona International Film Festival, San Francisco Documentary Festival, and the Downtown Film Festival Los Angeles. It was there that his film Sycamore was awarded Best Green Film. You see, for years, Joel has lived with this notion that art can change the world, and Sycamore was one small step in that direction. In Sycamore, that's S-I-C-K-Amour, A-M-O-U-R, he sets out to improve the life of a Charlie Brown-like tree right in the middle of the giant Rose Bowl parking lot in Pasadena. Instead of a Christmas tree, it's a sycamore, asphalted in on all sides, its bark battered from opening and closing car doors. Joel's full art installation, video sculpture, photograph series, giant earring sculptures he made for the tree, and a documentary raised a lot of awareness about the sycamore's miserable plight. It also made a lot of viewers reconsider the environmental toll of urban development and inspire tree lovers in the community to demand new tree-friendly landscaping there and elsewhere. Public art projects ensued, and today 200 tree babies, offspring from the adopted tree, are being planted throughout Southern California. You'll find links to the Sycamore Project at WFDD.org. Joel's new art installation and film shifts from nature to human nature and the sometimes thorny notion of sharing. The Sharing Project investigates why we teach our children to share, while at the same time our society encourages and in so many ways rewards selfishness. The Sharing Project begins with the seemingly simple task of Joel teaching his young son Zeke to share. But the more Joel investigates the act of sharing, even with the help of experts from every applicable field imaginable, the more questions he has. In the process, the Sharing Project forces each of us to rethink our own preconceptions about sharing. Maybe Joel and Zeke will find answers in the forgotten early 20th century socialist Jewish commune of Happyville in South Carolina. But we begin with a look at sharing through the eyes of a child.
And a white man. Yeah, no touch my toes.
I started filming this when Zeke was around 20 months old. So I've been filming him and filming this project for already a year and a half. I went to school with him one day and, you know, first of all, let me just say, I'm not just saying this as his dad, but he's a really sweet kid. He doesn't strike me or other people as an aggressive boy in any way. But it was amazing to me when I went to school with him that there were all these conflicts that were occurring with him and with all these other boys about who had access to what. Like, these were all communal toys. This was at a preschool, and I had imagined there would be a lot more conflicts if the kids were bringing in their favorite personal things. So even with the communal things that were ostensibly for everyone, there were all these conflicts. The first one happened when Zeke was playing with a ball, and this other kid came up to him and just tried to take it from him. So, I mean, clearly, it would seem, at least at first glance, that Zeke had the right to that ball. He had it first. This other guy was trying to take it from him, but maybe not. I mean, like, you know, there's ideas of, like, turn the other cheek. Maybe he should have just given this kid the ball. I mean, my impulse, which was identical to Zeke, would be to retain that ball, to hold on to the ball. He was playing with it first. He had the right to it. And a teacher intervened and let Zeke continue playing with the ball. But even that doesn't seem entirely like a simple question. Moments later, there's another incident that happens. Zeke has a ball. Another kid has a ball. And Zeke is having a good time with his ball, but this other boy seems to be having even more fun with the ball. And so Zeke thinks to himself, or at least I think he thinks to himself, wait a minute, I want to have as much fun as this other kid. I want to have that ball. Even though I have this ball, I want another ball. And so he goes and tries to take that ball from the kid. Now, that seems wrong. And the teacher thought it was wrong and stopped Zeke from trying to take that ball. But when I was thinking about it, I was like, well, yeah, that does make sense, but we're in a culture that seems to applaud selfishness and even greed in all these different ways. I mean, so why are we teaching our kids to share or to not take the extra ball when we applaud accumulation in all these ways? So are we being consistent? And that became a really fundamental question for me in this project that I wanted to try to explore. Are we being consistent, and why are we teaching sharing?
These are really huge issues, and they extend far beyond just sharing a ball.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure this out, and I know that I certainly can't figure it out on my own. So I've been reaching out to a lot of people in a lot of different fields. They include trying to understand if we're actually teaching sharing, or are we pretending to teach sharing. So I've been talking to Zeke's teachers and his potential teachers, principals at other schools. I've been talking to psychologists. I've been talking to evolutionary biologists. I've been talking to anthropologists. I've been talking to philosophers, philosophers of science, historians, local activists. And the more people that I talk to, amazingly, in some ways, the less clarity that there is, because it seems like there's additional layers of complexity that keep opening up.
Give me an example.
I got into thinking a lot about evolutionary biology. And I was talking to this fascinating man at Duke named Alex Rosenberg. And he was talking about how it seems like, and there's been a lot of disagreement in the field over time since Darwin about the fundamental question would be, well, if it's all about competition, then why are we altruistic at all? And there's various theories. I mean, one has to do with kin selection. Like, we're nice to people that we're related to because on a selfish level, in terms of the gene, maybe if we're good to someone who's related to us, that benefits us in some way. Or maybe we're good to people, we share with people if we think that there's a chance of reciprocity. So Zeke might share to someone if he thinks that that person will share back with him down the road. Those are things that I recognize in myself in some level too. But the thing that really struck me was this idea that's been popularized more lately called multi-level selection, which is that fundamentally we're conflicted. On the level of the group, there's group selection that encourages us to cooperate with each other, to share with each other, because if a group cooperates, then it's likely to be stronger than other groups. But at the same time, we're wired to cheat and steal and to be selfish within that group to get ahead. And so we're fundamentally conflicted. That just really blew my mind because I recognize that. I'm like, oh my God, yes, I want to have a nice life for myself, for Allison, for our boys, for Zeke and Ozzy. But at the same time, there's part of me that feels that I'm not doing enough for others. There's a philosopher, Christian Miller, who's here at Wake Forest, who was telling me that even though there's all these different models for ethics, for how to be in this world, they're conflicting, but they all point to the idea that we're not doing enough. That really resonates for me. And I was thinking about this philosopher, G.A. Cohen, who makes an argument for socialism. And his argument goes like this. He says, when we go camping, no one thinks that one person should have more food than the other on a camping trip. No one thinks that one person has the right for a bigger tent. We all agree that all the food should be shared equally. And so if we believe that, then how come there's so much inequity? Like, if that's true, perhaps we should be distributing all wealth equally across all borders. Now, that seems politically very difficult, if not impossible. You know, and part of me believed that, but part of me also wanted to have a nice life, nice things for myself and for my family. And there's plenty of arguments, plenty of philosophers that would think that that's totally fine. So where's the line? And how does one figure that out?
Well, I wanted to know in terms of the timing of Happyville. I want to go to Happyville next. It seems like you've discovered this perfect vehicle for exploring the notion of sharing in a socialist communal setting. How did you find it? And well, describe it for us.
Okay. Yeah, I started to think about how in America, we may not have a lot of communes anymore. But there was a time where there was a lot of socialist experiments in this country, especially the 19th century. So I started going through literally bibliographies of 19th century communes and reading up about them. And I came across this one particular one called Happyville in South Carolina, which is close to us. It really grabbed my attention because, well, there wasn't much written about it, but the little that was written about it told this story of these 50 Russian Jews who moved from New York in 1905 to start this socialist community. And they were atheists, they were socialists, they didn't speak English, they didn't know how to farm, but they were able to make this thing work, at least for a few years. Between 1905 and 1908, they made a sawmill, they made a cotton gin, they grew food, raised livestock. There was really sandy soil. It was hard to grow anything on there. There were particularly severe weather, really, really terrible winters that made growing anything really hard. And they had a lot of trouble selling their goods for whatever reason to their neighbors. And they were poor to begin with. So eventually they had to retreat, sell the land, and go back north. But the story really captivated me because as a Jewish guy who moved from the big city to the Carolinas, I just felt a lot of kinship with these guys. They just felt really similar to me in some way. And I just thought, well, these guys were obviously really good at sharing because they lived all together. They shared everything in an egalitarian way. So I bet that if I had talked to them, I would have learned a lot from them. And there was an article that appeared that mentioned a descendant of Happyville, who I contacted. Her name is Marcia Savin, and I interviewed her. Really nice and interesting woman. And she had recordings of her uncle who had lived there. And I talked to her, and I spoke to this woman named Doris Baumgarten, who actually had an old map. No one knew where this place was. Like, they sort of knew. There was one article, a larger article, that was written about it in the 70s. And it was, you know, the, like, informative article about it. But even he didn't really know where it was.
Just someplace in South Carolina?
Well, it was near Aiken. But finding out exactly where it was not clear. So Doris had this map, and there was a nice man there named Gary Hooper, who, between these three people and myself, I was able to contact the owner. It was not clear who owned the land. It's 2,200-acre area that's used as a hunting ground now. Really nice guy, and he let me go there to film. And no one knew that there was an old commune there. And it was been in the family for 50 years. It was completely off the map. It had disappeared. This utopian past was gone. And like, there was barely any traces of it. And that fascinated me on a poetic level, because it just struck me that we're so distant now from these ideals of this pure kind of sharing in our culture, that the closest thing to me of where it happened from where I'm living now is almost entirely gone, and no one knew where it was. So going back there felt like this huge opportunity to try to recapture that in myself and to look for traces of this utopian past, to try to learn from these guys who I'm sure could have taught me a lot. I went there with my camera, and I was just filming this huge, huge space. And it was wild. I mean, there was wild hogs, there's rattlesnakes, there's all this stuff. But it was beautiful. I was standing on the dam that these guys built. There was an ancient tractor that was totally falling apart, trees falling on it. This giant building that there's a very good chance that actually was used in Happyville that was completely decaying. So I'm filming the ground, these buildings, the trees, and trying to imagine and look for, in some kind of poetic way, what was there before. And then after filming there for quite a while, like a whole number of, a bunch of days, I came back with Zeke. And Zeke has, he doesn't really play. He plays, but he likes building. He likes fixing things. He likes working with tools. He calls himself a worker man. So tools, like hammers, wrenches, all that stuff's really important to him. And we went there with his tools to try to fix Happyville in a poetic or metaphysical way. There's this Jewish idea called Tikkun Olam, which is about trying to restore the world in a metaphysical sense, to trying to, it's basically about trying to do good. So I thought that maybe if we went there with his tools, that maybe we can learn something about sharing and to try to fix this place. So we're working on the tractor. We're working on this old decaying home. And we're bringing his shovel and we're trying to dig and look and search in the land. And it was this beautiful day with Zeke that felt a lot of kinship both with him as well as these guys who were there 100 years ago.
When you look out at the landscape of what's going on in the world today, I mean, what through that lens, what are you seeing?
I'm troubled that we seem to be advocating policies that are directly opposed to sharing in a lot of ways. Hmm. I mean, we all know about Moral Mondays and the protests that have been happening here in North Carolina. And I've been interviewing activists like Charlie and Ann Wilson and talking to some people who've been here a long time who know a lot about the history, like Hayes McNeil. And it's not like it's only happening here. I mean, we have these kinds of issues all over the country and outside this country, too. But there's this massive discrepancy between the rich and the poor. Charlie Wilson was very much involved with the homeless in Winston-Salem, and he was giving me all these incredible numbers. There were 1,800 people on the street in the 90s per year, 600 homeless a day. And there's all these people who are unemployed. We're in the Great Recession. So how can we pass laws where we're cutting unemployment benefits, both in terms of the dollar amount, but also in terms of the amount of weeks we can get it, and literally refusing expanded federal funds for the unemployed? And how can we be refusing federal funds for expanded Medicaid coverage? I mean, that seems completely antithetical to the idea of sharing. I just don't understand it. And there's a lot of wealth here. There's a lot of mansions and a lot of money in Winston-Salem and in America. But there's a lot of people who don't have it. I don't know where the line is, but clearly people shouldn't be starving and people shouldn't be homeless. The question is how much, what the safety net should be, but it seems obvious that there should be good public education for everyone. There should be good healthcare for everyone. And if we're resistant to that, how can we be resistant to that when we espouse the belief in sharing? Why are we teaching that to our kids? We are because we believe, we know it's true. We do want to believe in sharing. But how can we be doing that and then be acting in opposite ways?
Artist, filmmaker, and Wake Forest University Assistant Professor of Art, Joel Tauber. This weekend is the official launch of his new work, The Sharing Project. The Sharing Project will eventually become a multi-channel sculptural video installation, as well as a feature film that'll premiere soon afterwards. The art exhibition is slated to premiere in Berlin at the Adamski Gallery for Contemporary Art in the spring of 2015, and in L.A. at Suzanne Wielmetter Los Angeles Projects, beginning in June 2015. There'll be preview events in L.A. and Berlin in spring of 2014, and there'll also be a movie for the big screen. In the meantime, you'll find links to the Sharing Project website, Facebook page, and more at WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. There's a fantastic 6-minute video preview there as well, including scenes of Zeke and Joel working away together with Zeke's tools on fixing the Happyville tractor. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's all cameras and film today on the show. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, it's performance artist, photographer Diana Green. She's here to remind us that sometimes it's okay not to throw away all those old dresses you never wear, especially if you've got lots of film handy and some great stories to tell next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got an homage to two black and white photography giants coming up in the second half of the show. We'll explore the mind-bending candids of early 20th century Leica legend Fred Stein and a chat with his son, filmmaker Peter Stein, and glamour photography by Edward Steichen, as described by Rinalda House curator Allison Slaby. That's coming up. But first, we keep it local with performance artist, photographer, writer, educator, and commentator Diana Green. A Dozen Dresses, The Recollection, is her fascinating multimedia work. Part memoir, part dream, part psychology, the show uses clothing as a vehicle for remembering key events in life. Diana explores the blurry intersection of the past and present through provocative photographs of and essays about her dresses from days gone by. Diana dropped by to share the quality stories behind A Dozen Dresses, The Recollection.
Well, I have a very good friend named Rebecca Edmonds who was visiting, and she is a writer and an architect, but was a former textile engineer. And we were upstairs in my closet just hanging out, spending the day together, and she started pulling out some dresses that were hanging and saying, "What is this?" And I would say, "That's my high school graduation dress." And she'd pull another one out and she'd say, "What is that?" Because some of them were really, really ugly, and that's why you had to pull them out. And I said, "That was what I used to wear to work." And suddenly, one after the next, I started seeing that I'd actually been collecting dresses. And it just became a seed that grew inside me. And we started talking about it. And then she could also tell me all about the dresses, the fabric and how they represented history and what they were called and how bad that kind of sleeve was. And it was really kind of funny and comedic and interesting. And I thought, I think I need to figure out why I kept these.
Yeah, because you're not a hoarder by nature.
Not at all. And I'm also really not a fashionista.
But I'm going to argue about that later on, because a lot of these dresses are not so hideous. There's some pretty cool ones in there.
Mm-hmm. There are.
I love those coincidences of which there are none.
I like the way you put that.
Yeah, she was right there, and you just... Well, so it's part memoir, part dream.
Right.
This exhibit, which initially A Dozen Dresses, now The Recollection. Do those lines blur? I mean, the part memoir, part dream?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. I think it's just a very thin line between what's real, what's remembered, what happened, what didn't. And the part that really does feel extremely dreamlike to me are the photographs, because I'm taking something from the past, illustrating it in the present, but yet trying to have it look like not right now. So there's a dreamy quality to it, and there's a dreamy imagining of how that might look and how to represent the dress based on the stories that I found connected to the dress itself.
I mean, this kind of puts you right in that terrain, right? I mean, was that really what I remembered, or what's that like?
I think it's fascinating, and I know completely that what I'm writing is false. It's based on some facts, but really, I don't know that it's absolutely true at all. Because who can say? You have people in your family who probably remember the same moment differently. So I'm not too worried about the truth. I just think that I've got the basic setup for each story, and then I'm actually...
You're comfortable with it.
I'm intrigued. I'm not imagining that this is a reporting.
Yeah.
It's a recollecting, and so it's going to be fuzzy and gray. Some is less known than others.
How would you rate dresses from your collection over years in terms of the senses, in tapping into... a memory, a feeling. You know how like you smell something and suddenly, boy, I'm right back to that time when I was a kid?
Absolutely. I had found really that these dresses, the texture, the fabric, the shape, is like a skin of who I used to be, a skin that I shed, a way that I inhabited it, who our bodies were. I think as women especially, we go through a lot of metamorphosis about how we feel about our body, how it looks, how it grows, having a baby, being overweight, being underweight, not knowing exactly how you looked, why were you even wearing that outfit? And then also feeling really sensational. There's something about a beautiful dress that makes you feel so beautiful, it can change your mood.
Steve Jobs was talking about his life being divided into different chapters. The, you know, losing his job at Apple, starting a, you know, a startup after that, his diagnosis with cancer, and divided up into, you know, like three chapters. And I mean, do you have that sense in terms of chapters of your life? Do the dresses play into that at all?
It was really interesting because I am very much a present day, present moment person. I don't dwell a lot in the past, and I'm really not a nostalgic person. But here I kept these dresses. So it made me go back and remember who I was. And we forget who we were on some level. And it was interesting to go back. It was actually very painful, some of it. It's not just all joyful. I mean, some parts were really tough to write about and think about. And I think it shows up in the mood of the photograph.
How long was it in the making?
A little over a year.
Has your perspective on the exhibit per se changed over the course of the year?
Oh, yes. Because when I started, David, I wasn't thinking about an exhibit or all the writing. I really, when I begin something, especially that feels maybe larger or unknown, I just work quietly and just explore and discover and write without thinking about it and write a lot and write badly and write short, whatever it is that has to happen. And over time, it started developing. But the process was to write all the stories that I could about these dresses and then begin photographing. So this was all story-based.
What's great about these shots for me is not just the texture, the dresses themselves, the material, and kind of what you're doing photographically, but the settings for some of these, too. Really creative. Beginning with, I'll call it the hay bale shot. And this dress, I mean, there's glass. There's a hay bale. There's a measuring tool of some sort, maybe all in a kind of a Madame Curie-like grayish tent dress. That's an interesting scene.
That is one of my personal favorites, too. I call it the wench dress. And it looks like a wench, and I think the reason I called it that is that I was called a wench. It was a very seminal moment in my career as a broadcast journalist. You'll appreciate this.
I was called a wench?
Yes, I was.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
And so I was working at an ABC TV station, and I was wearing this huge, it looks like a smock. It is a smock, and it's the color of winter hay. And so I set it with the hay bales behind us with empty milk jugs, and you can't see her face. In all these pictures, you can't see the models, my collaborators' faces, because I want it to be universal and sort of every woman's story, and I don't want the face, the personality to intrude. So I had this moment where I was at the cafeteria eating some crackers, and the salesman that I vaguely knew came in, looked at me, continued to look at me, and then he said, "You look like a wench." And then I had this moment, and I can read to you from the script if you want that I wrote, because it was this really sort of paralyzing moment of awareness.
That's right. Let's hear it. Because in the exhibit, again, you're going to be setting the scene for each dress and that period in your life. And this is a great example of that.
Exactly. So I was 23, and this comes late in the story when he said it. The salesman left. I watched him go, feeling slightly stung. Like an insect or a bee got me, but I hadn't yet found the bite's exact location. I felt exposed, addled, about 12 years old, in way over my head. A wench? Wasn't a wench the earthly kumquat serving pints at the pub? Weren't wenches Shakespearean? Weren't they the bosomy milkmaids, the ones squeezing teats into a rusty tin bucket? Was this who I was? Was I a wench? All I knew for sure was it didn't sound promising. It didn't sound like what you would call Leslie Stahl or Diane Sawyer.
You're confronting, in some of these cases, a human being's most fearful emotion, which is shame.
No, this is not "look how great I looked" kind of exhibition. It's really like the vulnerability of who I was and as I grew. And there are moments of beauty, and there's sorrow and mistake. It's all in there. It's loss, it's love, it's sex, it's everything.
Well, speaking of vulnerability, and this is, I mean, coming from a guy who's, I think maybe I dressed up as a woman once in junior high for Halloween, but I haven't worn a lot
glad
of dresses
to hear
in my
it, David.
Day.
Nice.
Just going
to
throw that out there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the dresses, a couple of them, are so delicate, and the one that spoke to this kind of vulnerability in a sense, to me, just that delicate dress, that white dress with the lace pattern in the back and the buttons.
Mm-hmm.
Again, with the model's back to your camera, this dress, so delicate. When did you wear it, and how did it make you feel?
This was a dress when I was a bridesmaid at my brother's wedding in Napa Valley, California. And it's a beautiful dress. It's really like a flapper dress. It's lace see-through with a nice slip underneath it, which is a look I really do love. And I didn't know it at the time that I took the photograph, but one of the buttons is undone, which I actually really like. And I think this is part of why making art is so interesting, because it shows you things. You have an idea of what you're looking for, and then it comes back at you, and it starts to teach you and show you and open you up to new ideas. So it was a very nice affair. Weddings are, of course, very beautiful and planned, but there's usually a little bit of drama behind the scene.
Oh, yeah.
And this one was a mixed bag. It was extremely exciting and beautiful, and yet there was a lot of family tension, and my mom was particularly having a really hard time. I was the sister who was chosen to be in the wedding. My sister was not. that made me feel pretty guilty, and it's a limp that I have in my life, that element. And so I was playing with some of that, that mixed beauty and a little bit of feeling like I don't want to be in the spotlight.
Interesting.
I want the dresses and the mood to be very sensuous and textural, and you want to touch them and feel them like you really can. Because when you talk about a dress, it's always about the fabric and about what it's made of and how it feels on your skin. It's a direct contact with you personally, physically.
I'm spending a lot of time looking at these photographs, you know, wondering what it, even though the model, the individual inside that dress is not the focal point, you've got the backs turned on all the shots. I'm still trying to get inside, interestingly, the mind of, because I know you, I'm imposing you on these photographs a lot of times, but, you know, what's going through this person's mind? What, how is this dress making them feel? What occasion was it worn in? All that good stuff. I think if I was going to look at this, I would kind of look through the photos first and then come back and read what you've written about them to see, was I anywhere in the ballpark? Not that that's important, you know.
No, I like that. I want the photograph to be a door that opens for whomever is looking at it, and to have it be full of a bit of mystery and ambiguity, because I think there's a lot of photographs are just sharp, crisp realism, and you think, oh, no, it's an apple, it's a dress. And I want there to be that dreamlike quality where you don't quite understand what happened there, but it's still real interesting.
There is a dreamlike quality in one of these photographs. I'm going to call it the bamboo photo, in which the model is walking away from camera. Of all the photos, probably the most distant, in a black dress, in this bamboo forest, literally walking a tightrope up a fallen bamboo. And you're saying all these shots were taken in Winston-Salem?
Absolutely.
Is it the turnaround across from the children's home, that bamboo forest?
It's right by Graylin.
Oh, okay, yeah.
There's a lot of great places in the city to photograph. You can pretend you're anywhere, but that one is, that's a dress that is very sensual, makes you feel extremely sexy. When you zip it up, you can't wait to take it off later. You know that's coming. And that's just also half the fun of being a woman getting dressed.
And that shot, I gotta ask, because I mean, it looks like it almost would have had to have been photoshopped. I mean, these are all shots in the scene?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, I do shoot digitally, but I don't do very much post-production. I just balance out the color and do some cropping, but I'm very low-key that way. So everything is as you see it, but you must know I took many pictures to get that one beautiful photograph.
Sure.
In these images, as important as the clothing is and the texture and the setting, I'm very interested in gesture and movement. So each one has its distinct physicality to it as well, what they're doing. And with her in the bamboo, she's just delicately going inside to kind of a private place, which I think that kind of intimate relationship is.
I got to ask, so did she have to sign a waiver in terms of accident?
She did. Her lawyer talked to my lawyer.
Okay. She's way up there. She's bouncing on a big bamboo pole. Don't fall.
That's why you work with young people.
Well, let's wrap up on an upper photo, and this one of you, I don't know who the model is. I'm imposing Diana Greene on all these models, but a young woman running up these steps with a bouquet in her left hand and this flowing white dress, and the light is coming out, and boy, it looks expectant in a good way.
It was supreme happiness. That was my high school graduation. We all had to wear a white dress. I had a Mexican wedding dress, which was really cool back then, ethnic cha-cha. And I was so happy to be graduating and leaving high school. I was like such a degenerate in high school. I didn't know for sure I would graduate, and I did. Yes, I did. And I was thrilled to be leaving and leaving the confines of a boarding school where I grew up and moving on. I was so happy to move on. I don't know about you, but that was a big moment for me.
And this one looks like a white summer dress. The model is dancing. I see more of the face of this model than any of the others in the group of 12. And then that cool use of light. How did you get that lighting effect there? It's almost like a disco lights. What are those?
Those are disco lights, actually. This was set in 1976. I was lucky enough to go to the inauguration for Jimmy Carter, and I was dancing all night long with my brother. And so this was the dress that I wore, and it was the disco era, and this is a nylon, trilobal nylon dress, which is all part of that period. And it is the best dress of the dozen. And I made little Christmas lights at the bottom, and I also just kept the lights low. It's very simple. I actually don't use any lighting, natural light, and then just these disco lights and then the Christmas lights. And I just wanted to capture that swirl and being lost in the music. And I think most of us can relate to that night when you just danced all night to every song.
Winston-Salem-based performance artist, photographer, writer, educator, and commentator Diana Green. She was talking with me about her multimedia experience, A Dozen Dresses, The Recollection. But Diana's always got some new exciting project underway and a cool website to boot. You'll find links at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we come back from the short break, we take our hats off to two of the greatest photographers of the last century, Fred Stein and Edward Steichen, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Cinematographer and New York University Graduate Film School professor Peter Stein has been director of photography on more than 50 feature films, working with many of the major studios and TV networks. He's also worked tirelessly to bring the images taken by his late father, street photographer pioneer Fred Stein, back into prominence. In a recent traveling exhibit, Triad viewers were treated to 70 of Fred's amazing photographs at Ambleside Gallery in Greensboro, captivating black and whites of Paris in the 1930s, New York in the 40s, as well as Stein's now famous portraits of people like Albert Einstein and Salvador Dali. Peter spoke with me by phone from his studio in New York for this look back on his father's incredible life and work.
He was a brilliant student in Germany. He was born in Dresden, Germany in 1909. And he skipped a couple of years in the Gymnasium, which is the German high school, which was sort of unheard of in those days. But he was very involved politically. He was involved in the socialist youth movement, and it was a very strong anti-fascist, anti-Nazi. And he would ride around on his bicycle and give out literature. This was in his high school days. And he would also give talks against Hitler. And then, of course, when Hitler was elected chancellor in 1933, that became very dangerous. But he would still continue doing that. And my mother, who was going out with him in college, thought he was crazy. And he said, no, I can look into people's eyes and I can tell, you know, if they were committed fascists somehow. And even though it was very dangerous to do something like that, he still continued doing that.
Was that movement, the socialist youth movement, made up of people of all religions?
Yes, the Socialist Youth Movement was an anti-fascist group of organizations, and it was democratic socialism. It wasn't in the United States you think of socialists as sort of communists, but it was very democratic, and it was through changing things through democratic means, elections and so on. And he was really a humanitarian. He was a person for the people. And he wanted to help the underprivileged and workers and people who were not living the good life, let's say. And he saw through communism and Stalin and Russia, and he was very anti-communist. And in those days, many people in general thought that as Hitler became more and more powerful, the only means of controlling Hitler was to turn to communism. And Fred Stein was very much against that. He was all for democracy and freedom and for elections. So his brand of socialism is more what you would find in a country like Sweden or Germany, the democratic socialists, as opposed to what you think of here as being, you know, ultra-left-wing.
Well, that forward political thought and just active engagement on what was happening all around him probably saved his life.
Yeah, let me just go back a little. He had graduated first in his class in law school. And in Germany in those days, in order to practice law, you had to spend 2 years in the state prosecutor's office as an intern in order to be certified to appear in court. And that was a government job. So he graduated in 1933, and that was the year that Hitler came to power. And Hitler was actually elected Chancellor of Germany. And one of the first laws that he instituted was that no Jews were allowed to work for the government. So although Fred was this brilliant lawyer-to-be, he couldn't work for the government, so he was never going to be able to practice law. So he got a job through a friend of his in his friend's father's factory as a law consultant. So he would prepare briefs and so on for the other lawyers who would go to court. And one day his friend told him that his father had warned him that the SS had come around asking questions about Fred, and the week before, they had asked questions about a young woman who disappeared and was never heard from again. So he warned Fred that he needed to leave Germany right away, which he did. He left with my mother on the pretext of taking a honeymoon, and they went to Paris, where a friend of his lived. But their intention was always to return to Germany. Everybody in those days figured, well, Hitler is going to be out in a few months, 6 months, a year at the longest. You know, then he wanted to be close by so he could come back and reestablish democracy in Germany, which is why he went to France.
Unfortunately, that dream never came to pass. Fred, along with all German passport carriers in France at the start of the war, was picked up by French authorities and sent to a German internment camp. He eventually escaped, but Fred was no longer able to practice law, so with very little money and a small wedding gift to themselves, he and his wife set sail for the States.
He needed a profession that wasn't tied to a country, and his hobby was photography. And he and my mother bought themselves as a wedding present a Leica camera. It was the first model Leica. And the Leica was an incredible camera because, as opposed to the previous times where you had big wooden cameras and you needed a tripod and so on, the Leica was handheld. The film was on a roll and you could take one picture after another and you could take picture in low light. So he became one of the pioneers of street photography and documentary photography, which was just starting in those days, 1933 in Paris. That's where many of the great street photographers started their work. Fred's photography was very interesting because quite often he would relate to the people in his pictures. And so at least one person very often, if it wasn't a still life or a scenic picture, very often there'd be one person relating to him. And I don't even know how to put it in words. He was such a human person. He was non-threatening, and he saw people. I mean, he was an outsider in the United States, in France. He was an outsider, an observer, but he was a humanist, and he really liked people, and you could see that in his photographs. People are not threatened. Very often, I'm a cinematographer, but to take a picture, I don't know if people are different today than they were in those days. I guess photography was a little different then because it was so unusual for people to be taking pictures on the street so casually.
Cinematographer and educator Peter Stein. He spoke with me from his studio in New York. Peter's taught at SUNY Purchase and the School of Visual Art, and he's lectured on cinematography at several universities around the country. He's been on the NYU graduate faculty since 2002, where he's head of production. Peter brought the retrospective exhibition of his father's work, the late Fred Stein, to Ambleside Gallery in Greensboro. 70 wonderful examples of the master photographer's unique take on the city's street scenes and the people who fascinated him most. You'll find links to more information and a sneak peek at the current Ambleside exhibit at WFDD.org. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. From the streets to the stars, next, with glamour photographer Edward Steichen and a gallery tour with Rinalda House Museum of American Art curator Allison Slaby. It was among the top five things all North Carolinians should do, according to Our State magazine. It was called the top fashion exhibition by Lucky magazine, and maybe most telling of all, the granddaughter of the man whose photography was being honored called it the most creative installation of his work that she'd ever seen. That was Star Power, Edward Steichen's glamour photography at Rinalda House Museum of American Art in Winston-Salem.
You like if Mae West you like, or me undressed you like, why nobody will applaud.
Allison, who was Edward Steichen?
Edward Steichen was one of the most important early 20th century photographers, but he's also incredibly important to the story of modern art in America because he was living in Paris and he had a partnership with the photographer Alfred Stieglitz in New York, where Steichen would gather up the work of avant-garde European artists and take it to New York to exhibit in Stieglitz's Gallery 291. So the two of them, Steichen and Stieglitz, were the first to introduce the work of Matisse and Picasso and the sculptor Rodin to America. So this was really the introduction of modern art to America. And this exhibition examines a second part of his career after he returned from Paris. He was living in New York. He was convinced that he was going to devote his career to photography. And he took a job with Condé Nast, and he became the chief photographer for Vogue and Vanity Fair. So he brought this grounding in modern art, in aesthetic sensibilities, in technical mastery of photography to his work for the commercial realm. He's unique as an artist in that he really saw no difference between fine art
and commercial art. And so he spent really 14 years dramatizing and glamorizing Greta Garbo and Gary Cooper and Gloria Swanson and all of these luminaries of Hollywood, in addition to people from cultural and other realms such as Winston Churchill and Amelia Earhart and Eugene O'Neill. And the work that he created for Condé Nast is really some of the most iconic photography of the early 20th century.
This particular exhibit here at Rinalda House, Star Power, has been garnering lots of praise from various sources and some very, very meaningful sources as well, as in within the family. What are you all doing in a unique way? What are you doing right?
Well, when we started looking at these images, we were really struck by the fact that the years that Steichen was working for Condé Nast, 1923 to about 37, were both the golden age of Hollywood, but also the golden age of Rinalda. These were the years that Catherine Smith Reynolds was living in the house, buying furniture for the estate, buying fine clothing for herself. The same thing happened in the next generation with her oldest daughter, Mary. So we were struck by the fact that there was so much visual resonance between Steichen's photographs and costumes in our costume collection, furniture that we have in the house, even jewelry that the family owned. And so we decided to create an installation within the exhibition that draws these parallels. So there's a fabulous flapper gown that Catherine wore in the 1920s, and you can see gowns like that in Steichen's photographs. There's a wonderful long evening gown that Mary wore in the 1930s, and so you can see the transition in fashion from the 1920s to the 30s. And then you can see gowns like that in Steichen's photographs, in addition to amazing diamond jewelry by Van Cleef & Arpels and Cartier, and fabulous cloche hats from the 1920s, and then this just show-stoppingly beautiful bright red Chanel scarf. And so you can go back and forth and make these connections between what Steichen was doing, capturing these elements of fashion, and what Catherine and Mary were doing at Rinalda in purchasing amazing things for themselves and for their own home.
When I look at some of these works, I'm struck with this connection between me and the individual being photographed in so many cases. Maybe it's the dress, maybe it's just my unfamiliarity with that period in time, but there's a realness to that. But I'm curious about your take on this great photographer and what resonates with you.
Well, that's one of the most amazing things about Steichen's work, is that he was a master on so many levels. He was a technical master. He could manipulate composition and manipulate light in order to focus the viewer's attention on a particular aspect of dress or face or expression. He could get from his subjects what he wanted from them. He could pull them out and make them more glamorous, more dramatic. He also had the ability, when he was working in a particularly commercial realm, to focus the viewer's attention on a product. So if he's photographing shoes, you are going to look at those shoes and they are going to be the most fabulous shoes you've ever seen. In so many ways, he's just a master at what he's doing. And this is really, I think, these years are kind of the height of his creative abilities and aesthetic sensibilities.
Well, maybe we could take a look at a few works that strike you and you can talk me through.
Sure.
So here we are in the Charlie and Mary Babcock wing of Rinalda House and the Edward Steichen Star Power exhibit. So, Allison, what's a piece that kind of touches base on, I guess at first we were talking about individuals, and this is really stunning right off the bat.
One of the most iconic photographs of 20th century art is Steichen's photograph of Gloria Swanson. She was a young actress when he photographed her in 1924, and it had been a long shoot. I think they were both exhausted. And he hit upon this idea of draping a film of lace in front of her face, and he said that she recognized the potential immediately. He said her pupils dilated, and she took on a look like a cat looking out from leaves in a jungle. And it's just one of the most dramatic photographs you'll see, and just stunning in its beauty.
Cat-like. What a great way of putting that. It's exactly what it is. And the texture of the lace in the face is really striking, too. How about another in terms of drawing your attention to a fashion element, Allison?
I'm glad you asked that, because in this same year, in 1924, he created this incredible photograph of Ilka Chase, who was the daughter of the editor of Vogue. And he wanted to highlight a new hair ornament, and it's a tortoiseshell band that wraps around the back of the head with beautiful diamond embellishments on the sides. And so he posed her with her back to the camera and focuses on just the beauty of her profile and this incredible hairband. And I think for our visitors, this image is really going to call to mind Downton Abbey and perhaps Lady Mary and something fabulous that she would have worn in that show.
I'm also struck by the modern, as in contemporary, 21st century look of some of these photos and the gorgeous detail. In that one, it's reminiscent of the modern day headphones that are worn backwards today by the young kids.
Exactly. Steichen was very modern, and you see him throughout the exhibition becoming more and more modern. In the 20s, when he started, he was still doing this soft focus, what we call pictorialist photography. But as you move through the exhibition, you see him becoming sharper, the images become crisper, there are these very deep shadows, and you see him moving from almost an Art Nouveau look to very much Art Deco.
Rinalda House curator Allison Slaby. She took me on a gallery tour of Star Power, Edward Steichen's glamour photography. You'll find several Steichen photos and links to more information on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. While you're there, you can follow links to the latest goings-on at Rinalda House Museum of American Art. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Kirsten Bowman. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes at WFDD.org. I want to remind you we've got two special editions of Triad Arts Weekend coming up in December, Triad Holiday Celebration 1 and 2. This year I want to make it an extra special event for our local musicians, authors, actors, and of course WFDD listeners. For Triad musicians, please email me an MP3 of your best holiday performances. The address is triadarts@wfu.edu. And Triad writers and actors can send me an MP3 of your winter holiday poem, short story, or dramatic reading. Keep it 5 minutes or less in length if you would, and we'll consider including it in the broadcast as well. The music or reading can be from any part of the world, but it must relate to the holiday season. The deadline for receiving your MP3s is midnight on December 9th. Again, the email address is triadarts@wfu.edu. And I look forward to hearing your holiday finest. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.